Our main speaker, Chris from San Antonio. There's some water, okay?
Thanks. Zima? Just kidding. My name's Chris Raymer. I'm a very grateful recovered alcoholic. I hate wide rooms. It's just, I can't see these guys. They could be naked and on fire, and I wouldn't see them. I don't. They are, yeah. I'm delighted to be here. I've never spoken in Vegas before. That was a commitment I made with my wife, because we come out here to sin on occasion, and it was one of those places you could come to and be completely anonymous, you know, because everybody's always pulling on you, and now I've screwed that up. So, because I'm sure I'll see some of y'all out there sinning too. No doubt. That's the first thing she asked this afternoon. Did you play any slots? It's like I'm cheating on her, you know. Anyway, I got to thank Bob for asking me to come speak, and I know Bob probably hates this worse than I hate people that do it to me, but he's been kind of a hero of mine for years and years and years, and people always asking me, well, what speaker tapes do you listen to? You know, and it's Bob Darrell's crap. You know, it's good stuff. It's good stuff. And I like speakers that'll say something. They'll get to a point. I love hearing stories. We all have them, and most people find them pretty boring. I don't know what to tell you. After you've heard them a few times, you know, I get tired of telling my own story, for heaven's sakes. I came into this program so hungry when I finally got here. And I want to mention this before I get into this. In this little tirade, because some of y'all have heard CDs of mine, and I've got some friends in here that have heard me a million times, and I'm so glad to see them again. But I'm a chronic relapser, folks. It took me forever to get sober, and I know we've got some of y'all in this audience that are just like that. I was 7 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, picking up chips, never got a cake, never even got close to a cake. When I finally got sober, you know, I caught fire. It's just like, it was one of those like a V8 moment, like who knew, you know, because I'd been doing things so wrong for so many years, and then all of a sudden my life just changed almost overnight, and I became quite excited about it. And I'm 18 years sober. I got sober November 13th, 1987, and I was talking to a buddy of mine in Dallas not long ago, and he said, "You still on that damn pink cloud?" You know, and he's like, "What?" I need to let any newcomers in here know that there's no such thing as a pink cloud. If there was, I think it would have been in the big book. It's called God's grace. And I'm pretty excited about being sober. I'm delighted. But I do come from a very passionate standpoint about Alcoholics Anonymous and our responsibility to this fellowship. And I know that grinds some people. And I work at a hospital at a treatment center in Texas. And I've been blessed to have that job for a long time. And I get to see lots and lots of alcoholics and addicts come through those doors. And I watch so many of them not get this. And I watch so many of them die. I lay awake at night and see their faces and listen to their families cry after they overdose or drink themselves to death. And then I feel kind of obligated to come up here and share something with you with some substance perhaps. But I was talking to Bob earlier. You know, I'm the older I get, the more conscious I am of your feelings too. And I know all of us are not on the same page, and so I just want to tell you right now, going in the door, for those that I'm fixing to offend, I love you, and I don't want to make anybody uncomfortable. I think I've made every mistake that you can make in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still do, and 70 years ago, we had a couple of cats that got together that couldn't stay sober, and they realized that together they could do what they couldn't do by themselves. And they put together from stolen material from the Christians and psychiatry and lots of different religions, they put together some things called the 12 steps that seemed to work where nothing else would. And that message over the years has been lost in certain areas of our country, of our world. If you're going to open discussion meetings and you love those meetings and you love to hear people share at depth about the problems they're having today, and you're staying sober in those meetings, welcome. You're probably not an alcoholic anyway, but I'm off to a great start, aren't I? Anyway, I got sober down in the hill country of Texas. Y'all know where San Antonio is? It's right kind of in the center of Texas. And Kerrville's just a little up west, up in the hills. And I live a little further, about 6 miles further up in the hills. It's like the Appalachia of Texas. It's a lot of inbreeding going on over there. And family trees just have one little stalk comes up, you know. And it's like, y'all think I'm kidding. It's an amazing place to grow up. And I left at high school because I swore I would never go back. And of course, you know how God works. It's, well, I got another idea for you, you know, and I'm back there. But my dad was an alcoholic, nicest, kindest, gentlest man you'd ever want to know, very talented craftsman, and died of this disease. And alcoholism is one of those diseases that'll kill you drunk or sober. So many people don't realize that. So many people out there believe that if I just stopped drinking, everything would be okay. And he was proof positive that you can stop drinking. My experience abundantly confirms it. I don't get better when I stop drinking. I get better. Somebody said it earlier today. I get better for a while. I put more money in the bank and wash the car, for heaven's sakes, and do, you know, paint the house about 6 times. I mean, I do a lot of stuff. I stay real busy, so my mind will quiet down a little bit, you know. But gradually, the things that the book talks about, the spiritual malady starts to return, and the depression starts to creep back in, and the boredom, and the self pity, and one day you wake up, and the pain of staying sober just outweighs the benefits, and this little thought crosses your head. With me, it's always this, you know, you could probably smoke a joint, and I'm. And I hate pot, and I know it going in the door. Don't like marijuana, but, you know, I still think today it's the worst drug out there. Who wants to take a drug that makes you horny and paranoid all at the same time? I mean, I know maybe some of it doesn't affect you that way, but I just hated it. But my mind would always go there because, you know, I don't have a problem with it, so I could probably get away with it. I got to have something, a pill, some power, something to make me feel okay inside. That is not a normal reaction to alcohol. It's just not. You know, I should have known early along. I got hit in the eye with a rock when I was a kid. I'm sure some of y'all were just dying to ask me that question. I'll just save you the effort. And a rock fight when I was about 11 years old. And I just firmly believe that if I'd had a shot of vodka, I would have two eyes today. You know, I was uncomfortable in my skin, and there was a guy out there. Let's go pick a fight with this guy. And we went, got out there and started throwing rocks, and he was a better aim, and I didn't duck quite fast enough and lost my eye. It's just that, yes, there's an eye there. No, you can't see it. Get this out of the way. I don't know. I've been doing this a long time. I know it's coming. I'm just, yeah. Anyway, I remember alcoholism is we've got this little threefold thing. We've got the spiritual malady we just talked about, this internal discomfort. But we've got this phenomenon called craving that makes it virtually impossible at certain times, not every time, but at certain times, to control how much of this substance we're going to put in our body. My intentions were always to drink a few drinks, get right, go get laid, you know, or go make some money, whichever. Usually, get laid was the most important thing for me. One of those things when you're homely, Well, never mind. But y'all laugh, but it's, I could, if you couple this physical allergy with this thing called a mental obsession, which tells me that this time is going to be different, that this time I'm going to be able to control it, even though you've got 1,000 examples to show that you can't, then you've got a demon on your hands. And that's what alcoholism is. Guys, it's genetic. It's genetic. It's been proven without a shadow of a doubt within the last 5 years. Genetic. Any of you little cats sitting around in here blaming mom and dad for it, you other than the fact that they got together and did a little pokey pokey, it had nothing to do with what they did. My external world, your external world, I've absolutely exacerbated the problem. Some of us in here that have been traumatized and had some bad things happen to us, it absolutely added fuel to the fire. Would be the last to say it didn't, but it did not cause the drinking. The book is crystal clear. If you can stop on a non-spiritual basis, you're not one of us. Which means you got to have this thing called a spiritual experience. Which means we don't really need to be walking around on eggshells about this topic called God. Because it's a part of the program. Open and roomy, make that God anything you want. I'll give you whatever you want, but it's going to be something. Y'all with us? I remember I was a late bloomer. How old were you when you started drinking? It was like a baby, for heaven's sakes. I must think 17 or 18. It was between my junior and senior year of high school, the winter before I graduated, that I picked up my first bottle of booze and drank it. I was a late bloomer. My father was an alcoholic. I didn't want anything to do with that. I steered clear of it, you know, but I was so uncomfortable in my skin. And this guy said, "You want some Boone's Farm apple wine?" And I said, "Absolutely, let's try it," you know. And we gave it a shot. And he didn't like the taste of it, gave me the rest of the bottle, and I didn't like the taste of it either, but I drank it. And for the first time in my adult life, I felt comfortable. And I was a busboy at a big hotel there in Kerrville, and on my way up. And I wanted to be a professional chef, but that was the ground floor. You'd be a busboy first. And so, and I remember that one of the cooks had given us a beer at work, me and a friend of mine. And we went out back and we drank it, and it was excellent. You know, and this is after the Boone's Farm incident. And we went back in, and I stole another bottle of beer, and we smuggled it out to the car, and you had to use a can opener to get a bottle opener. You couldn't, there was no twist top stuff, and unless you were a real He-Man, and I'm not, so wasn't then, am not now. And if I didn't have a can opener, a bottle, so we went to this little filling station that had one of those Coke coolers out front, and I went in there and I grabbed it and I stuck it in there like that, and I popped down on that and I broke the top of that beer bottle off. Well, clink, heard it clink. Oh, geez. And the guy says, "Oh man, Chris, what a bummer," like that. And I sat down on the edge of the seat looking around for cops, you know how we do, and looked at it like that, and took a big old pull off of it, and God, that's good, you know. And I handed it to him. Remember, I can't see him on this side. He's on the passenger seat, and I turn around, and he's like deer in a headlight. He's looking at me like, "Are you nuts? It's got glass in it," you know. And it's like it didn't even slow me down. Sieve it out, buddy. That's what teeth are for, you know. I don't understand what your book says. Given sufficient reason, can you leave it alone? There's crushed glass in your beer. Can you not drink it? We're just not wired like other people. And I didn't understand. God dang, the phenomenal cravings kicked in and I have to drink. None of those thoughts came through my mind. I just knew that I had to get a drink, and I did. He didn't drink any of it, which was super with me. Went to Houston, apprenticeship program in the food business, and as a chef, and did well, folks. Talented, got a chef's job right off the bat, and started making some money. Was drinking every day, doing what so many of us in this room have done. I was one of those functioning alcoholics, guys. I had a period of time where everything was going pretty well. I was not getting drunk every day. I was not robbing liquor stores or doing any weird, goofy stuff. But I was abusing the daylights out of the substance. And It gradually got worse, of course. But what was really getting my attention was this undercurrent of depression that was kicking my rear. It was quite obvious to me that the only time I could feel comfortable in my skin was when I had alcohol in me. And when I didn't, I was very anxious. Some of y'all have tried to talk to me today, and I usually answer questions with one word. I was shy then. I am shy today. Painfully shy. But it was to the point of absolutely anxiety at the early years of my life. And beer was the only thing. Alcohol was the only thing that would lube me up. Late 70s. As when I started eating my first medication to treat those disorders. I'm seeing a therapist, and she believes I'm suffering from clinical depression and possibly bipolar disorder, and I'm eating a lot of pills to take care of that. Of course, I'm drinking on top of that, so I'm not having much success with the medication. You can probably imagine. Again, folks, I'm pretty successful at what I'm doing, though, and my external world looks pretty cool. My family thinks I'm doing great. I'm getting written up in chef magazines, and I'm rising star in Texas and the Culinary Institute, and I just this kid's doing it, but I'm crazy, and the women are coming and going. I if you go out with me once, it's a hostage situation with me, and I was the original stalker. It is terrible. I'm so insecure. Again, the symptoms of the spiritual malady. I depend on your approval to be okay. And it's just, it's not a happy time. And it's one thing you can say about my entire life up until the time I got sober, I was unhappy. I was never comfortable in my skin. And ended up in North Texas. I got married when I was about 30, and because I knew that would fix it. And I become responsible, put down some roots, get married, buy a home. That'll fix everything. And I did. And, of course, it didn't fix Jack. She was a nice lady, wonderful woman, and I was just crazy. I was just nuts. We moved up to North Texas to get away from all of my druggy, drinking friends in Houston. And I went to work at a country club whose chef was a drug dealer, and I'm one of the worst alcoholics I've ever seen, it got bad and got bad quick. I ended up in a little domestic disturbance, how you promise yourself when you're young, I'll never do that, and then you do it, and then you just kind of raise the bar. Well, I know that was but I'll never do that. But I'll never do that. And so many of us in this room, we've compromised ourselves right out of the rooms. We keep doing stupid stuff. We got in a shoving match at the house, and she got scared, and I freaked out. I got scared, and I was loaded to the gills, and the cops came, and the cops left, and I crept back in very early in the morning and begged her forgiveness. And it was one of the first times that I'd ever really wanted to quit. I had thought about it for years because I knew it was a problem. It was affecting lots of areas of my life. But when I promised her I wasn't going to take a drink, I meant it. And I had some dope, and I poured it out, and I got rid of the alcohol, and I said, I'm done. And I didn't touch a drop, buddy. For 2 weeks, I didn't touch a drop. Somebody offered me some alcohol one night, and I said no the first pass. And the second pass, I says, what the hell? It's just a beer. And I drank a beer and drank a couple that night, but I didn't get drunk. Two beers. And I went home patting myself on the back. Look, honey, I drank two beers. See, my deal with her was not that I wasn't going to come home drunk anymore. My deal with her was that I wasn't going to touch another drop because she'd watched that stupid experiment 1,000 times. And she was done. She went to the bedroom, packed her stuff, and moved back to Houston. First divorce, and I blamed her for the next 7 years for my drinking. It accelerated, of course. I'm single now, nothing to stop me. I'm a basket case, physically, I'm coming apart. I started out drinking in the nice clubs, and I ended up drinking in a bar called the Jolly Rogers in Lake Dallas, Texas. How many butt whippings do you think a guy walking in with a patch is going to get in a bar called the Jolly Rogers? It just boggles the mind, truly. And I'm working for my twin brother. He's an alcoholic in recovery also, and he's a pistol. And we were thick as thieves. He's my best drinking buddy. And he got sober a few months after I did, and I'm so grateful for that. He owns a big bookbindery up in North Texas, and I went to work for him because I couldn't cook anymore. I couldn't do the work. And I'm insane. You know, I'm hearing voices, and the anxiety is getting so horrendously deep that I'm starving to death. You know, I pull up in front of Kroger's because I got to go in and get a couple of things like peanut butter essentials. You know, bread, peanut butter. And I can't go in because I'm afraid to walk in. I don't know if any of y'all have experienced that, but I mean, there's the two scary moments of the week is when I've got to go get groceries and got to wash clothes because I can't seem to get drunk enough to do it. You know, I can't make up my mind which way to turn left or which way to turn right. I'm coming apart. The pill, I'm taking 7 pills a day, folks, trying to stay level. And they're obviously not working. The only pill I don't think I was taking was Viagra, which I probably could have used in hindsight. But I left work one cold November night and went and got a 12-pack and went home to my little apartment. I lived in a little efficiency apartment by myself, and I had a couple of ferrets in there and whose cage hadn't been cleaned in years, and it was a mess. And there was no furniture in my apartment. I had some furniture one time, but my drug dealer, I lent it to my drug dealer, who needed it worse than I did, obviously, because he still got it. And I'd picked up a stack of return checks in the mail and sat on my floor and opened them up one more time and realized that I had bankrupted another checking account. I'm 35 years old, and I don't like my life. I'm living in a town I don't want to live in. I'm driving an old $600 beat-up pickup truck. I got no friends. I got no girl. I have nothing. I've been drinking for 20 years, and I know nothing's going to change. I know in the morning I'm going to have to go to my sister-in-law, and I'm going to have to ask her to cover those hot checks. You know, family members, I think through the miracles of Al-Anon, can get a pretty good idea what this is all about. But I don't think anybody who's never been in our shoes, and some of y'all in this room might be in that category, can understand the absolute desperation of somebody that desperately wants to stop and can't. You tell somebody that you love that you're going to quit, and you let them down. That's great. Once. Try doing it hundreds of times. And pretty soon you don't even buy your own BS. And it's a place of absolute hopelessness. That's what drives me crazy when I first started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in the early 80s. This whole time, I'm going periodically. And, you know, the best that they can come up with in the meetings I'm going to is, just don't drink. Just don't drink. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do I do that? Just don't drink, come to meetings, everything's going to be okay. I'm going to ask you this one thing, guys. If you're sharing that in meetings, please, let's reword it. Because it's absolute rubbish to a newcomer. I got the go to meeting part. I'm doing that, hundreds of meetings. But it's the not drinking that I'm having a little problem with. Oh, I could stay all day on that right there, but I'm not. Bob asked me to be nice. I'm going to be nice. Just kidding. I got up from the floor and stacked the return checks on the counter and went to the medicine cabinet, got a couple bottles of pills down, and swallow them down with some alcohol. Wasn't a lot of thought about this. I'm not a big one for suicide. I don't know. This was not a planned thing. It was just, I'm so done with trying to get sober and not being able to. I'm sitting in these meetings and I'm watching you cats, and you seem to be able to do it. You're getting cakes and stuff, for heavens. You're doing okay. Your life seems to be going okay, but I can't just, I can stop for periods of time, but I can't stay stopped. And I'm not hearing the reasons why. Now, folks, that's my story. I got people come up after I speak. I don't care what, where, town, country I'm speaking in. Somebody come up. Surely in 7 years you heard the solution. You're not hearing me. And I'll take partial of the blame. Maybe it's because I didn't know the questions to ask. You know, we assume that the newcomer should know all the... I didn't have a big book. I didn't know where you got them. I didn't. I'm driving around all over Dallas, Texas, looking for a big... Walking into B. Dalton's books. I need a big book. And the little teller, you know, all right, look inside. How big a book do you need? No, I mean... A big book, you know, like nobody told me that you couldn't buy them in the bookstores. You couldn't back then. You get them in AA meetings. Well, where were they? They're not in the AA meetings I'm going to, because I'm going to open discussion meeting hell. Y'all know what? All right, let's go. All right, all right. And 10th step right now. I'm sorry I'm going to offend you, and I hope I don't. Because I've done all of this. What's up with this dry air and these little boogers? What is that, normal? Is that normal? I feel like I've been on a 2-day run here. The meetings I went to, the first time I went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, the guy sat me down and said, Chris, do you have a problem with alcohol? And I'm drunk. You know, I've been drinking all the way over. And I said, yeah, I got a little problem with alcohol. He said, welcome. And I sat down and, you know, we did our usual little meeting and keep coming back. It works if you work it. And they're out the door and everything is great. I said, well, this is not so bad. But they never qualified me. Because I'm looking around the room and you guys are staying sober. But all we did in that meeting was we told a bunch of war stories, and when we finished with the war stories, which I found fascinating, about for the first 100 or so times I heard them. Let me mention something about war stories. Our stories are some of the most powerful things we have. It's probably the biggest tool we have in our kit for helping newcomers. It's called a 12-step call. That's when we're supposed to use that from the podium. And in a 12-step call. But sitting in a meeting, telling your story over and over, once I've identified, yeah, that's it, that's me. When are we going to get to the solution? Like, I know what the problem is now. Can you tell me how to... No, we didn't up there. North Texas, we didn't. We just told war story after, like we're going to scare each other into recovery. I keep looking for the chapter in the back of the book, Into Scare, and I can't find it anywhere. It freaks me out. Everybody thinks when I'm speaking from the podium, they pick up these stupid CDs and they listen to this. He's knocking our story. I've never knocked our stories. It's the biggest tool we have. I'm just saying we overuse it. I watch the women coming into our goddamn meetings. And nice little businesswoman. She comes in, sits down, and everybody's eating a little ham sandwich, fixing to go back to work. And she's freaked out. She got caught drinking at work. She thinks she's got a problem, so she comes in. And everybody wants to start telling their war story. Well, I've had a DWI. Well, she didn't have a DWI. Well, I've had 2 DWIs. I've had 3 DWIs. I've had 6 DWIs. I've had 15 DWIs and robbed a liquor store and chopped up 15 people. How's that? And it's great from the podium, but in this particular meeting, why are we sharing that? What happened to common sense? You know, if those people in the early 80s had talked about waking up in the morning and looking at yourself in the mirror and wanting to die, I could have understood that. But I'm a corporate chef. I make good money. I have a wonderful, loving family around me. And I am not going to jail. To scare us into recovery. That's why we can't keep the young adults in our meetings. They can't relate. Read the book. What does the book say? 12-step call. Tell your story. Then tell him about God. Tell him about your experience in recovery. Pull him with a vision. That's what it talks about, but that's not what we do a lot of times. I know some of y'all in here do, but the groups that I was in, they didn't do that. And I couldn't relate to their stories. When we finished with the stories, we started the junior therapy sessions. From the groan. I know some of y'all love those too, don't you? Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I'm sitting in the back of the room having polished off a quart of beer before I walked in, dying, knowing it's going to be a miserable day. But we're going to come in and talk about somebody's problem that has nothing to do with alcohol. Let me ask you a question. I've talked about it from every podium in the last couple of years. Let me just ask you the question. Fifth tradition tells us what our primary purpose is. Our primary purpose is to carry the message of hope to the alcoholic. What's our message? 12 steps. Y'all cool with that? I don't know about here in Vegas, but in Texas, you know, you get a little crackhead come in and he starts talking about the cocaine and boy, they'll shut him down and excuse me, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. We just talk about problems with alcohol here. Okay, that's cool. I'm with you. Cool. But what's the difference? You want to come in and talk about your stupid divorce one more time. No, what's the difference? It's got nothing to do with alcoholism. We'll listen to your problem at work, or the kids, or the this, or the that, or this. What's 7 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I cannot figure out how come you're staying sober and I can't stay sober. And it brought me straight to the culmination of a suicide attempt in 1987. I got those pills down my throat, and about the time they hit my stomach, I heard a voice that said, "Chris, don't do this. Go back to AA." I looked around. I live in an efficiency apartment, and in the medicine cabinet window, you can see the entire apartment, and I'm looking around, you know. It was that loud for me. I mean, I know it was just in my head, but "Chris, don't do this. Go back to AA." Scared me to death. Hair stood up on the back of my neck. I made myself sick. Laid down on the bed, and I heard it one more time before I conked out. "Chris, don't do this. Go back to AA." I'm arguing with the voice. I ain't going back to AA. I have picked up so many desire chips, I jingle when I walk in the rooms. I'm not going back to AA. I have drawers full of them. I woke up the next morning and I heard the voice one more time. And I called the doc and I called my brother, told him I'd be a little late, went by the doctor who'd been trying to get me into recovery for years. And he gave me some doggy downers to start detoxing. And I couldn't go to treatment. Guys, I was broke, flat busted. We didn't have a nice detox like we went to this today at lunch. There was just nothing available where I was living. After work, at 6 o'clock, I drove back up to an AA meeting, and I parked a couple of blocks away so nobody could see me go in. I didn't want anybody to know I was getting well again. Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked in the back door of an AA meeting, and sure enough, I'd heard about this meeting. This was the big book thumpers hung out there, and I'd avoided it like the plague, and because I didn't understand what the literature was about. And I walked in, and everybody in the place had a big book on their lap. They were smoking. Back in the day when you could smoke in these meetings, and the ceiling's coming down on top of you, you know, the smoke. And Jesus, I walked in, and everybody's laughing and having a good time, and I am freaked out. I don't like them. I'm grateful I wasn't carrying a gun that day. I'd have shot them. Because they're laughing, and I know they're laughing at me. I walk in, check my patch, make sure my zipper's on. Oh, and there it is. Everything's cool, and little girl, I'll never forget her, about 19 years old, got between me and the door, because I'm backing out. And she got between me and the door and hooked her finger in my belt loop and pulled me down in a chair. I learned later on her sponsor was heading for me and couldn't get to me in time and pointed to get him. Because they knew I was leaving. I said, "Sit down, cowboy. You ain't going nowhere. Just hang on." And they got me a cup of coffee, and I sat down, and I'm freaked out. Y'all got to know, I look rough now. I mean, at my best, I look rough. But I was 60 pounds, 40 pounds probably, was all right here and a big full beard and long hair, and I hadn't bathed in days. And I mean, I was a patch perpetually crooked. I looked like I'm walking around with an earmuff all the time. It's like, I look ridiculous. And the little girl sat there and patted me on the deal, and I see a lot of people today. I talk to a lot of people that, you know, we're starting a new young adult meeting. You know, and I never jump on that bandwagon because my experience shows me quite clearly. If she'd have been off in a young adult meeting, I'd be dead tonight. It's just, guys, it all boils down to the little stars lining up, for heaven's sakes. And she was there, and she caught me, and I stayed just because I didn't want to make a scene. And they went around the room, and this chairperson had seen me up in North Texas for years, and he they said, enough of the war stories, guys. Let's pull this cat with a vision about what life is like in sobriety. You folks that have worked the 12 steps and your life is better, why don't we tell this guy about it? And I set up, you know, so come on, bring it on. And they did, folks. And they talked about stuff I could get my teeth into. They didn't talk about walking with little sunbeams with Jesus. They talked about getting their credit cards back. They talked about getting married and buying a house and getting a new car and getting your teeth fixed for who knew? What a concept, you know? At the end of the meeting, I mean, they had my attention. And an old geezer got up afterwards and came over and had those glasses on, you know, and he looked over and he says, "Buddy, what are you going to do different this time? Let me ask you one question. Are you done?" Guys, they didn't ask me, "Are you ready to try this one day at a time?" They didn't ask me that. I'd been asked that for 7 years, and the answer was always yes. He said, "Chris, are you done? I know you don't have the power to do this, but can you make a commitment that you want to try this for keeps, for a change?" Never had been asked that question. And I said yes, and he hugged me just like people do in AA. The next morning, they set me down before the 10 o'clock AA meeting and opened the book. And for the first time in 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, they qualified me. They opened the book up in the doctor's opinion, and they started talking about the physical allergy. "Chris, can you identify with this phenomenon of craving?" "Yeah, we talked about it a minute." So they went to the obsession of the mind, this mental obsession from 23 to 43. And he just went straight to page 24. Have you lost the power of choice in drink? And we talked about it, and I said, yes. And I started to feel a tension in my gut, which I know today is called a first step experience. And folks, that was my bottom. It was not a suicide attempt. It was not the DWI. It was not the lost relationships. It was not the lonely nights. It was seeing that I was screwed unless I was going to have a spiritual experience. That was a first step experience for me. Once you've got somebody hooked like that, buddy, they're never going to get off. They talked about the spiritual malady. "Yes, yes." He said, "It's real simple, Chris. Do you believe there's a power out there greater than yourself?" "Yes." Never had a problem. Guys, I was eating out of dumpsters in Houston, Texas. I always knew that God was there with me. That's why I survived. I never had it. Me. You may have. I didn't have a problem with God. Something's out there. He said, "Let's go." We went in the back room, got on our knees. Four or five of us got down, and we did a third step prayer. We explained in that third step prayer how God was going to remove my difficulties so victory over those difficulties could bear witness to God's power, just like those people had done to me the night before. Cool. Went and got something to eat, came back. They gave me a notebook. Says, "Let me show you how to do a four step before you go on home." Guys, I'm 2 days back in Alcoholics Anonymous, detoxing, and they're working me through a four step. And I talk about that from podiums, and people laugh and poke the guy next to me, and that's so fucking stupid. I've been here for years, and I hadn't done a four-step. You know, I understand, but the last laugh is on you, not me. Because I'm going to tell you, folks, those old guys knew that if I didn't get connected to God and get connected to God quick, I was going to die. No human can relieve my problem, folks. No human can stop me from drinking. Bob and I and some of the cats at dinner, we were talking about this There's some great literature written about it. Ernie Kay wrote a great paper on it. It's called This Little Window of Opportunity, folks. It's a little place. It's where the pink cloud got its name, folks. It's a lot of you have experienced it. You come in and all of a sudden the zeal of the fellowship and even before you start working the program, the fellowship starts to drag you along and you start feeling pretty good and you realize one day that the obsession is gone to drink. But it's temporary, folks. It's not going to last long, and I can't look at you and tell you how long that window's going to last. For some people, it seems to last for months, and some, it doesn't last but a few days. And Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob and those first cats understood that. They knew we didn't have time to mess around with this. God, we got people coming to our treatment center that have left other hospitals, and they're working on the all great American novel. We call it a fourth step. You know, if you do it the right way, you can do it on a couple of pieces of paper. But you're going to fill a half a notebook full of your crap. That's not what the big book says. It's not what it says. Get this stuff out. God. I started working on that fourth step, and I started realizing from the first pieces I started to write down, I started to realize that I was not the victim that I was playing. Guys, I could milk that victim stuff. Oh, boy. You don't know what it's like to be blind in one eye. Buddy, you say that in the right group, you'll get laid. I can tell you from experience. And some of you are doing it in here now, I can guarantee you. You're milking it. You're milking it. And I'm going to tell you something, guys. It's a terrible place to be. If that's the only thing you can get out of life is by guilt tripping somebody, it's a terrible way to be. These guys sat me down and showed me how to do this, and I started writing and realized I hadn't been a victim. I'd been a volunteer. 2 weeks later, guys, I've got a completed fourth step. I'm done. I've been done for days. And I drove home after a Friday night meeting, 2 weeks to the day that I tried to commit suicide, and I pulled down the tailgate of my old pickup truck because I'm feeling strange. And I look around me, and there's a 7-Eleven and Stop and Go and a Circle K. I got a bar across the way that I got a tab in. My dope dealer lives in the apartment complex I live in. It's a Friday, and I got a pocket full of money. I'm surrounded by triggers, man. Everywhere I look, you know, there's something. See, the difference is I'm doing the work for the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the obsession to drink is lifted from me. Folks, I introduce myself as a recovered alcoholic. I've been recovered since 2 weeks into this program. Not once. In 18 years, has the obsession to drink or drug returned to me? Those are the promises that the 10th step gives us. Treatment centers killing people every day, telling them this, oh, geez, all the people's opinions and what they think, it just freaks me out. Well, my sponsor said, I don't care. My therapist, my counselor at treatment said, I don't care. What does the book say? Because you don't have to defend this. Tell them, baby. Thanks, Mom. And that's what I mean, I could go on and on and on, but I don't want to. It's way past my bedtime. But I. When I first got to this fellowship, I got to tell you real quick. The first week I was there, they had me doing service work. Everybody's so freaked out. I know in Texas they're huge about it. If you go join a big club and they tell you, you know, you can't sponsor anybody for the first year you're sober and you can't work with any others and you can't get service until you're 2 years and all this, which is just exactly opposite of what the book says. Page 129 tells us that we absolutely suggest strongly that you get active working with others so that you can stay sober. But we got somebody that thinks that you should wait 2 years. I mean, I've heard it from a million podiums. Thank God Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob didn't think that way. They were sober a few months, and they're out there working with others. That's how we're supposed to do it. Because, see, guys, I was ready to die. I felt so useless. You know what, this low self-esteem stuff? You want to feel better? All of you guys that ever stood in front of a mirror and told yourself that what a good boy you are, you know, and then you left kind of disappointed because you didn't feel really good. Those positive affirmations that you just knew were going to work that didn't work worth a poot. You with us? Try this. The same thing they had me doing. I'm sitting in there 2-3 days into this deal, still detoxing. Little new guy come in the door. Chris, go get him. What would you be? Hey, don't you remember me? I just got here. The newcomer, the most important person in the room, he said, Chris, that was Friday. You were the most important person in the room, but you're not a newcomer anymore. You've been here 3 days. Oh, man. Chris, we didn't ask you to go show him how to work the steps. Can you go show him where the coffee is? Can you tell him where the bathrooms are? Can you make him feel comfortable? Let him know what's going on? Talk to him? Just go up and shake his hand. I don't want to do that. Chris, you're a taker all your life. It's time you start giving. You want me to sponsor you? Yes, sir. Go shake his hand. It wasn't suggested. We suggest. These old timers didn't suggest Jack to me. They said, buddy, we're going to go to the halfway house. Grab the big books. Let's go. Oh, no. I'm busy. I have to work in the... They just look. What? Did you hear anybody ask you if you wanted to go? We get the big books. I didn't like it. They saved my life. Because I got busy and I got active and I got to feel what it's like to sit across from somebody else that was in worse shape than me and got to realize that I could share some hope with them. It was the coolest. That's how we got here, folks. That's why we've lasted 70 years. One alcoholic sharing his hope with a new alcoholic. That's how it works. Unfortunately, in our fellowship today, we've got a whole bunch of people that don't understand that. They're sitting in meetings, guys. It's nothing that'll make me sadder to watch than a whole bunch of people sitting in our fellowships, miserable, bone powder dry. Well, I'm sober 16 years. You know, I'm writing hot checks and I'm cheating on my wife, but I haven't had a drink today. So I guess it's been successful. Absolute rubbish. You're missing it. Let's go get some guys to work with, folks. It's all about the 12th step. It's all about working with others. I told this story and I'll get out. I was in Houston not long ago and driving through torrential rain. It always rains in Houston. And I look over, which is odd for me on the right-hand side, but I look over and there's a big ditch along the side of the road there. Driving down Westheimer, and there's utility work. And you got two little Mexican guys down there in the ditch digging their butts off, just wet as could be, you know, just working their rears off. I'm stopped at this light, and there's seven or eight guys standing up there with rain slickers on, you know, with clipboards, you know, checking the job, you know, executives. And I'm thinking, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. You got a handful of us down in the trench, busting her butt, answering 12-step calls, signing up for every job there is to be signed for. You got the same people sponsoring all the women, all the men sponsoring. And you got a whole bunch of people sitting around on their hand doing nothing. But coming back. I keep coming back. Everything's okay. Come on, guys. You're missing it. You're missing it. This is not about not drinking one day at a time. This is about feeling the power of God. This is about getting passionate about your life again, about going out there and starting businesses and going back to school, doing the cool things that we're supposed to be doing. I know I sound like a Baptist minister up here. Next thing I mean, praise God. You know, I'm sorry, but life is cool in sobriety. But the only way I can keep it, we were talking earlier about the guys that we've known that we got sober with who are no longer with us. Why? What happened? First thing that happened, they stopped going to meetings. They stopped sponsoring people. They got too busy to work with a newcomer. And the next thing you know, they're back in picking up a chip. I did that for 7 years. I don't want you to do it. I work at a hospital where I do clerical work, and I sit in front of a phone and in front of a computer, and I talk to alcoholics and addicts all day long. And the cats that leave our hospital and come back to groups like this where we study the literature, where we don't sit around and talk about our day, which we can do after the meeting or before the meeting, but during the meeting, we talk about the literature. When I get them to groups like this, these cats stay sober. There's some of them in this room right now. And the cats that don't, that go back to open discussion hell, they gradually become so uncomfortable they can't stand it. And then they drink again. Let me ask you a question before I go. When did it become okay not to tell the newcomer how to get well? Sit in a meeting next time you're in and close your eyes and see if you hear enough for the newcomer to grab hold of. Interesting experiment. It'll make you cry if you're in a wrong meeting. I sit in front of that computer and I get emails from all over the world, people that are having the same experience that with me. And it is a delight to stay in touch with you cats. I always have business cards, guys. If any of you guys want to stay in touch, man, I would be honored to do that. If you ever need anything I can do for you, if you've got a problem, you just want to bounce something off and talk, that's what the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is about. It's not for 1 hour a night. It's for our lives. And the fellowship is pretty deep, folks. If you're having any kind of problem that I can help you with, buddy, email me or call me, and I'll be there. Cool? I love Vegas. I get to come out next month. Next month? No, it's May. In May, my brother's going to be out here. He is, I'm going to set it straight now. He is the evil twin. I am not. But we'll get a chance to come back out here in a couple of months and visit with you guys, and then we can all go sin. I'll see y'all later. Thanks.